exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Larry Tye. Larry Tye is the author of The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. How are you doing today, Larry?
I'm well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you a very big question. What do we learn about America when we talk about jazz?
I think we learn clearly about this all-American music form, but your listeners and you don't need me to tell you that. Everybody knows how wonderful jazz is and how wonderful the three guys that I wrote the book about. I think we also learn that jazz is a lens into much more than just music. It is a lens into how America works for better and definitely for worse. And it is a lens into how America changes, hopefully for the better.
Larry, why Armstrong, Basie, and Ellington and not, say, Buddy Bolden, Miles Davis, or Charlie Parker?
So it ends up being a subjective choice, and everybody I talked to came up with their own list of three. Mine were chosen partly because they were all three born within 5 years of one another at the turn of the last century, partly because they came from such different parts of America, one from the deep Jim Crow South, one from a border area, which was Washington, D.C., where you are, and one from the north, New Jersey. But it was also because these three did something that almost nobody else did then or can do today, although I think you're going to defy my expectation with it. They lasted at the top of their profession for a full 50 years. And that says something about them, and it says something about the country's reaction to them.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the research that you've done, Larry, were there any things that you discovered that you didn't know? Did anything about any of these three individuals that you say, well, you know, this is very interesting. You know, I've come across something that maybe many biographers miss, or maybe they didn't mention it in their own biography or memoirs.
There are two kinds of things I came across. One is the small picture, and the small picture with Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong was details of their lives. When were they really born? What were the circumstances? Where did their nicknames come from? Things that are fun, but are at the margins. With Count Basie, because he was so enigmatic and so private and almost secretive, everything I feel like I came across was relatively new because the world knew so little about him. Count Basie wrote a memoir called Good Morning Blues, which I'm convinced three people in the world read. One was Count Basie. The other was the poor and terrific author who worked with him, a guy named Al Murray. And the third was me because I had to read it. And it was written like a boring travelogue. And it was, I think, intentional in terms of not revealing much about the Count. And I think the secrecy that has shrouded his life is a function of what I came across as the secrecy that shrouded his early years. He, I think, didn't know until he was older that he had had a second brother who was born before his parents were married, who never lived with them because they weren't living with one another, and who tragically died at age 6 months of malnutrition when another woman was taking care of this baby. And that was part of the general secrecy in the family as he was growing up. And I think it made him wary about ever telling the world too much. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that was perfectly suited to his role in the jazz world. He was the consummate band leader. Unlike Ellington and Armstrong, whose ego, along with genius, came through in much of everything they did, Count Basie was trying to extract wonderful sounds from his instrumentalists and from his vocalists. He wanted to stay in the background, and it was fitting with his secrecy. But I said that's the small stuff. The bigger stuff and the things that I presume we will talk about are the other half of these three guys' legacy. They left not just a legacy of what they did with their music, and they were perpetually telling us they wanted their music to speak for itself, but they left us a legacy in how they changed the world and wrote the soundtrack for the civil rights revolution.
You know, I'm chuckling because when you mentioned Count Basie, I remember working at Howard University for over 40 years, and those Count Basie books never moved. You know, they were just there. No, nobody assigned them. You know, the Duke Ellington Music Is My Mistress, that moved off the shelf, I guess, because of the title. But the Count Basie books never went anywhere.
They didn't. Well,
right. Well, why did this book take you over 25 years to do?
So it took me that time because it goes back to the reason I wrote the book in the first place. And I wrote the book because almost 25 years ago, I wrote a book about some Black men who worked on the railroads who were called Pullman Porters. Mm-hmm. And that was an extraordinary job from the end of the Civil War when the Pullman Company started. For the 100 years that it lasted, they were arguably the best work that a Black man could get in America in terms of everything from getting to see the country to the salaries they earned to getting to hobnob with America's most famous and wealthy people. And I promised the Pullman Porters that someday I would write another book about their three favorite passengers who were named Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie. And I think if I could take 1 minute here, I think the reason that the Porters loved these three jazzmen, I think says a lot about the Porters, about the jazzmen, but most importantly about our country. And they loved them because they got to know them when these three musicians went below the Mason-Dixon line in that Jim Crow era of racial segregation. If they chose the wrong restaurant to try to eat in or the wrong hotel to try to book a room, they could be berated, they could be beaten, or they could be worse. And so what they did to stay safe was every time when they could afford it, and they could afford it all the time, when they could afford it, they would rent a private Pullman sleeping car to go with them. And if they were performing a concert somewhere like Atlanta, that car would be on a sidetrack at the railroad yard. And when they got done with their performance, they would go back to the Pullman car. They would know they had a great meal waiting for them prepared by the dining car staff. They had a plush bed made up for them by the Porters, and they had a place where they could be safe. And in return, what they would do in the middle of the night was perform a private jam session for just the Pullman Porters. And I don't know about you, but if I could go back to any moment in history, that would be a pretty nice time to have the Duke Ellington Band playing just for me.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Duke had a really plush train car in terms of how he traveled around the country in style.
He did. And he had that train car was a Pullman car whenever he could, whenever he was going overnight. So Duke lived well. He made a lot of money. He made a lot of money for his sidemen. His managers took a lot of money and stole a little bit of money. But Duke always managed to live in style. And that was the way that Duke, with his aristocratic nickname, wanted to live, and he was talented enough that he could do that.
I also recall, it might have been Claude McKay, I think, there was also the concern by Pullman Porters. You never knew what was going to happen coming into a city, whether it might have been a race riot or whatever, but there was always that concern about people's safety going from city to city.
There was huge concern, and long before there was anything called a Green Book, there were informal networks. The Porters traded stories with the Negro League ballplayers, who traded stories with musicians. And they knew that in the Selma, it might be Mrs. Smith's house where you could get a good bed and a good meal waiting for you. It was somebody else in every city. And there was an exchange of information for exactly the reason that you said, which was you show up without knowing where you're going and where you're trying to find a place to eat or sleep, and it was potentially a fatal decision.
You mentioned reference the Negro Baseball League. You wrote a biography of Satchel Paige, and there are many stories and myths surrounding his baseball career. In writing about someone like Ellington, how did you navigate the stories and misinformation surrounding his life, and how do you separate the myth from the man?
Same way I tried to do with Satchel. With Satchel, I started out as with him as one of my all-time heroes, but me being skeptical about all the claims he was making. He had pitched 2 million shutouts. He had more no-hitters than anybody else in baseball ever. He had all these amazing stories. So what I did was what any old journalist like me would do, is I went back and read every newspaper. I tried to get every record there was. I interviewed everybody who had ever studied the Negro League history in terms of statistics. And in the end, I concluded that Satchel actually underestimated a lot of his stats, that if all the records were really there, that we would prove that this guy who pitched a couple innings just about every night of the year for just about 40 years, in fact, underplayed what he had done. And it was the same technique I took with these jazzmen. I interviewed 250 people. I read every biography, every newspaper and magazine story, everything that had ever been written about them, and I tried to separate the fact from the myth. And what I found was that some of their facts were a little bit off. Louis Armstrong loved giving reporters a different birthday every new reporter he talked to, the same way Satchel Paige had. It made a great story when he said, I was born on the 4th of July at the turn of the century in 1900. You know, what more momentous date? Well, the truth was that his birth records were no longer available in New Orleans because in the era that Armstrong was born, the birth of a black child was given no weight. And those records somewhere along the way were destroyed. And so he could therefore play with it. This guy who had grown up in a Jim Crow setting where he was told, this is the water fountain you can use, and this is the one that's reserved just for whites. This is the park, and this is the school. When he finally got something in his own control, like his birthday, he had fun with it. And I found that people played with fun facts like that. Duke and the Count both told fibs about where their nicknames came from. And the truth is that both of their nicknames were ones that they gave themselves. They both thought that someday they would be worthy of aristocracy. They were right. And so they gave themselves nicknames that they liked. But none of that stuff in the end mattered. What mattered was that the essence of who they were, the genius of their music, and the essence of who they were as men pushing those racial boundaries was true and was more than they had ever claimed. And it left me feeling like my heroes were even more my heroes because they were now flesh and blood.
Well, let's flesh out this, what you just made reference to in terms of aristocracy. If we could also look at Duke Count, we could also look at jazz as being high art. And I was wondering, in terms of your research, do we now begin to say, okay, let's look at these three individuals, let's look at jazz, and let's bring in the whole issue of class as opposed to simply just race?
Sure. So if I can take 1 minute to just paint portraits.
We have an hour, Larry.
I'm going to paint brief portraits of each of them, which get to the issue of class as well as race. Mm-hmm. Louis Armstrong grew up in a part of New Orleans that was so poor and was so rough and tumble that it was dubbed the battlefield. And for the first 13 years of his life, he had to help his mother earn enough to give them food to sustain Louis, his younger sister, and his mother, that he would perform street hustles on the streets of New Orleans, doing anything from dancing to blowing a tin horn. And he was, at age 13, on New Year's Eve, he was grabbed from the streets by a detective and tossed into reform school. And he would say later that that saved his life, that many of the kids he was on the street with didn't survive into their teen years. And in reform school, he learned, in the fashion of Booker T. Washington, he learned how to do one thing so well that nobody could take it away from him. And that one thing was initially to play a bugle, then it was to play a cornet, and ultimately it was to play a trumpet. And he grew up poor and never forgot that poverty, as well as the whole issue of Jim Crow racial injustice that he grew up with. Duke Ellington grew up in a very different kind of household, in a very different kind of place. He grew up in the middle of what arguably was the black bourgeois Ground Zero of America in Washington, D.C., with a very large Black community and with a middle-class household that he grew up in. And when he was a kid, he lived in 16 different houses at different times when he lived in Washington. But when he was a child, in his favorite house, he would walk down a steep staircase in the morning before he went to school. And his little nephews, who were at the bottom of the stairs, he would tell to bow to him. He would tell his nieces to curtsy, and he would tell all the kids and all the adults, applaud, applaud, because someday the world is going to know me as the great, the grand Duke Ellington. So even from a young age, he had a sense of the royalty he was destined for, and he made that destiny happen. The third of our trio was Count Basie. And if I hate to say this, but if anybody in your listening or viewing audience has not been to Count Basie's hometown of Red Bank, New Jersey, don't bother going there. The only thing really worth knowing about Red Bank is it's an hour outside of New York, and it's where Count Basie grew up. And he couldn't wait to get the heck out of Red Bank. He initially thought the way out of Red Bank, where his father was a gardener, his mother was a laundress, and they were in a home that was wealthier than the Armstrong home and poorer than the Ellington home. And he thought the way out of town was to join the circus. He realized that he had this skill for plunking piano keys that was an even better ticket out of town. And he ended up going initially to the New Jersey suburbs and then to New York City, where he learned literally at the feet of the great Fats Waller, watching him play the organ and play the piano. And that was Count Basie's road to the bigger world.
You know, I'm laughing because you said Count Basie trying to get out of New Jersey. And I was thinking of Bob Dylan trying to get out of New York, where he says, goodbye, New York. Hello, East Orange. You know, he's going the other way.
Opposite direction.
Following Woody Guthrie, I guess. And stuff.
Very fun.
Take these three individuals, Larry, and you've just fleshed out briefly their background. How did they each handle racial injustice?
So in different ways. First, I'd like to give you a sense with each of them, the injustice they faced and then how they handled it. With Count Basie, the injustice took the forms of perpetual indignities, but one to me sort of is emblematic. He was performing at a theater in Philadelphia. He got literally 10 standing ovations. But when he got done with the performance and went out front, a white guy tossed him his car keys, assuming he was the valet, and said, go get my car. And this was the kind of thing that happened to him all the time. And one way that he fought back was in 1945, just at the end of World War II, he signed what became his standard contract that essentially said, no integrated audience, no Basie band. He insisted 20 years before Duke Ellington did that his contracts call for integration. With Louis Armstrong, he would be a headliner at Las Vegas hotels and nightclubs. And yet he would be told the only way you can get into this hotel is through the kitchen. And that was, again, a standard kind of indignity. And he had been accused for years by young Blacks and young whites of being an Uncle Tom character. On stage, he would ham it up. On television, he would pull out a dozen handkerchiefs and would do a bunch of entertaining as well as performing. And he was really tired of people saying that about him, because he knew what he had grown up with in New Orleans, and he knew how he had spent his life fighting back. He finally did that in public, where he, in 1957, in what was the biggest civil rights confrontation of that year in Little Rock, Arkansas, when the courts ordered the segregated schools to be integrated, and 9 young Black kids were about to integrate the all-white Central High School, a racist governor named Orville Faubus said essentially, over my dead body will these Black kids come to my school. And what Louis Armstrong did, a young reporter comes to his hotel room and says, what do you think about what's going on in Little Rock? He called the governor a word that begins with M and ends with R, and that I won't say over this wonderful public radio station.
So I can have a radio show this week.
But in the family newspaper, it got translated to an uneducated plowboy. He called our war hero President Dwight Eisenhower, who had refused to send in federal troops, gutless. And it made headlines around the world. Suddenly, this guy who had been accused of being an Uncle Tom was being accused of being an unpatriotic American. But he didn't back down. And I can't prove this, but I am totally convinced that the reason Dwight Eisenhower sent in federal troops to protect those 9 kids in Little Rock was because his beloved Louis Armstrong had called him out on the issue. So that's what Armstrong did in publicly pushing back then and repeatedly. With Duke Ellington, his situation that he was facing was one where one night when he was playing in Lynchburg, Virginia, the all-white hotel in town, the hotel whose manager was trying to give him a room at, said, "We will let him in on one condition, which is that we charge this extra fee for pillowcases and for sheets." And the manager said, "What do you mean an extra fee?" And the hotel guy said, "Well, of course, if a black man sleeps there, we're going to have to burn the pillowcases and sheets the next morning." And this is a kind of injustice that Ellington faced repeatedly until one day when he was in Baltimore, Maryland, and students at Johns Hopkins were protesting the fact that a restaurant called the Bluebird Diner wouldn't serve blacks. They pleaded with Ellington to join them in their sit-in, and Duke said no. They pretty please pleaded with him to join the sit-in, and he said no. They asked a third time, and he said yes. The headlines the next day across the world were Duke Ellington integrates Baltimore Diner. All three of these guys said our music speaks for itself, but all three of them did a whole lot more than their music to help topple the Jim Crow racial barriers.
You know, when you were talking about how Count Basie was treated, I was thinking of the similar story in which you had the historian John Hope Franklin, you know, gives a talk, and then somebody, when he's leaving, somebody asks, "Where's my Coke?" You know, those type of thing. And then when you were talking about Louis Armstrong and Eisenhower, I was thinking of the correspondence that we find between Jackie Robinson and Eisenhower. You know, where Jackie was very critical, and Eisenhower was saying, "Well, Jackie, you know, you've been a role model type of thing." And Jackie said, "It ain't about me; it's about other people." And I think that when you look at Louis Armstrong and Jackie Robinson, these individuals were not just concerned about their career; they were also concerned about their people. But I want to ask this question to you, Larry Ty: which one of these individuals wore the larger mask or the smaller mask?
So the biggest mask was definitely Count Basie. His mask was there all the time, from his memoir that we've talked about to his wanting to be in the background at the band, to not even his closest friends knowing exactly what he was thinking and how all this tension was building up in him as he worked as hard as he did and had all these indignities cast upon him perpetually. The one who wore the least mask was Louis Armstrong, who, whether it was his smiling or his deep introspection in his dressing room after he performed, where he had the saddest expression in the world, he was right out there all the time. He was making thousands of tapes telling the world how he felt about everything. Anybody who happened to show up, whether it was that young reporter in the Little Rock crisis or whoever it was, Louis Armstrong was eventually willing to bare his soul. And the one who seemed to be talking forthrightly, but in fact was wearing a mask, was Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington was the picture of elegance, of glibness, of eloquence, and yet how he really felt, as his son told the world in his son's memoir, and as his granddaughter Mercedes Ellington told me in perpetual interviews I've done with her, he was hiding from people his real feelings because he thought part of being an aristocrat was remaining above it and sort of putting on the good show all the time, and that's what he did. So my guess is that every black man who grew up in that era, who was at all public-facing, had to wear a mask in order for self maintenance and survival, but these three were in the public eye perpetually. Can you imagine being out on the road 300 days a year for 50 years, and it would wear on you?
I was wondering how you would look at Duke Ellington at the White House with Richard Nixon. I think they're playing the piano together. What is your takeaway from that evening?
So my takeaway is, having grown up in the Nixon era and having a certain take on who Richard Nixon was, it was on the one hand the idea that my hero, Duke Ellington, was there with a guy who wasn't my hero named Richard Nixon. It seemed like a contradiction to me. And yet it was a perfect reflection of who Ellington was. It was partly that blacks of that era, and it was actually in the Kennedy White House that this changed, but blacks from the days of Abraham Lincoln on had generally voted Republican. That was the party of Lincoln. That was the party that had been out there and more forthright and more willing to take a stand on civil rights. So it wasn't surprising that he was at least bipartisan. It wasn't surprising that if the president were honoring him at the White House, he'd want to be here, whomever the president was. And it wasn't surprising that he was incredibly charming. But the fun really happened that night when Nixon said, "Pat and I are going to sleep, and you guys can have fun in the building when we go." And people stayed up and they danced and they talked and they played all night. And I think that the Richard Nixon fancied himself, among other things, a musician, and he had played Happy Birthday to Duke that night. And it proved once and for all that he wasn't much of a musician, but that he at least tried.
Is there any truth to the thing about that Duke Ellington kissed Richard Nixon twice on each cheek, like sort of like this, he had two faces?
So he did. And that was the kind of kiss he did. He had this wonderful thing. He would tell every woman that he met that she was the one that he had written all of his sentimental songs about. And he would tell every man that he met that he was his role model. And Duke Ellington knew better than just about anybody that I've ever seen in the public or private world how to charm people and win them over. And that's why he was Duke Ellington.
And that's why Richard Nixon was Richard Nixon. He probably did that. Maybe he had four cheeks. Larry, we're going to take a little break here, and then I'm going to come back and ask you some more questions. I'm enjoying this conversation this morning. My guest today is Larry Tye. He's the author of Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, this is Miyuki. On Sunday, July 7th, 4 to 8 p.m., WPFW is presenting a fundraising evening of roots, rock, reggae at Mango Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road, Bladensburg, Maryland, featuring Proverbs reggae band with Z Lion and special guest Freedom and Soroma VL. Proceeds to benefit WPFW. Details at WPFWFM.org.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Larry Tye. He's the author of The Jazz Men, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. Larry, you wrote about a 1933 trip to Europe that Duke Ellington took. Hitler came to power in January 1933. How was jazz viewed in Germany during this time?
Jazz was viewed as classic in two different ways of the things that the Nazis and Hitler hated. One is they were a racist regime and they hated blacks. And the other was that they thought that jazz were the all-American gutter music, and the idea that there were Jews involved with blacks and performing jazz made it a triple threat to the Nazis. So on the one hand, they tried to ban jazz and ensure that people couldn't get access to it. And on the other hand, we have great stories of Luftwaffe pilots listening to jazz performances. There was no way to keep jazz down. And the more that it was an all-American music form, the more it was appealing to people in Germany as all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Talking about all over the world, and this is very important in terms of the appreciation of jazz. You talk about, and this is in chapter 13, talk about how European journals view jazz, because you could talk about various people writing from Scotland, England, and they were very critical of the music.
I will, but I want to, and I hope it's not inappropriate to do this, but I want to say one quick thing. I've been on for many books, WPFW, and I'm generally on during a fundraising period.
Right.
So what I'm about to say is something that comes naturally, which is if you love Mr. Miller as the great host of this show and you love PFW as much as I do, whether or not they're in fundraising mode, write a check. And the station happens, and we are able to have conversations like this because of this incredibly generous audience in writing checks. And now let's switch to Europe and to how the world saw these jazz greats. And in their early years, all three of them went to Britain and to France as their first destinations. And they got, on the one hand, they got their share of racist critics. And I talk in my book about some of the slurs, but they generally got a warmer reception than the critics in America were giving them. And it was warm enough that they drew enormous audiences in Europe, and that all three of them at different times and for different individual motivations thought about being expatriates, thought about actually not coming back to America. Why come back to a country that had these Jim Crow restrictions? You know, you were among the most celebrated musicians in a country, and yet you couldn't go into a nightclub in Las Vegas other than through the kitchen. This seemed nuts. And so they debated, and every time they went abroad, they got amazing audiences. Louis Armstrong was treated literally like a king when he went to Africa. He was carried through Leopoldville on a makeshift throne. He drew audiences in the tens of thousands. When the State Department in the 1950s and early 60s sent these guys out as informal jazz ambassadors, we were in that era. If you're listeners remember back, we were involved in a superheated Cold War. And the most damning argument that the Soviets used in appealing to unaligned nations, the argument against America, were that we were a racist country. And that was an argument they felt would have resonance in Africa and in Latin America and in other parts of the world. And so America decided to fight back by sending out three of the most prominent African Americans and most recognizable in the world. And it worked. And everywhere they went, including behind the Iron Curtain, they drew enormous audiences. And they were very free to criticize America and to criticize the racism in America when they were on our shores. When they went overseas, they became uber patriots. And when journalists would ask them in Russia or in Africa or wherever it was, what about racism in America? They would say, yes, there is racism, but we are fixing it. They managed to be optimists. And the last thing, and I don't mean to preach on this, but the last thing I would say is that they had to be optimists to suffer through what they did and last at the top of their profession for a half century. If you're a pessimist, you would have given up long before any of these guys did. And no matter the abuse they suffered, they were convinced, and I think they were right, that things were getting better. And I want to just say one last thing. It wasn't just me that says that these guys deserve credit for moving the dial on civil rights. It was a guy named Martin Luther King Jr. who said in a little notice speech in Brazil in the 1960s, he said, if not for these jazz musicians and their music, issues like integration of the schools would have taken a whole lot longer to happen, that they prepared America for the things we were trying to do in the civil rights movement.
I'm curious at how some of these musicians interacted with other individuals. And I'll use something that I actually witnessed. I remember when Howard University gave the great poet Sterling Brown an honorary degree. They also gave an honorary degree at the same time to Duke Ellington. And Sterling Brown was very happy that he was getting this honorary degree from Howard at the same time with Duke Ellington. And I was wondering, in terms of coming through the Cold War of politics, did any of these musicians have any sort of interaction with Paul Robeson or Du Bois?
No, it's a great question. And the answer is they must have, but none that they ever talked about either to journalists or in their memoirs. The two guys who influenced the world as much as those two did you would think they had to have come across one another, especially since they all spent so much time in New York. They were all part of the Harlem Renaissance. They were all part of this burgeoning movement and flourishing of art as well as of activism. We know that when Ellington first met Martin Luther King on the streets of Chicago, even though they didn't know one another at all, they embraced like they were old friends because they understood that they were part of this same movement. But in terms of Robeson and Du Bois, I don't know.
That's interesting because, you know, I came across some correspondence between Martin Luther King and Langston Hughes. And King said, oh, yes, I've been using your poems so often a lot in my sermons. So I wonder if the I Have a Dream comes from like Langston Hughes, and he just didn't get any credit. But you mentioned in your book, The Jazz Men, Larry, that you saw these jazz musicians as being patriots and consequently not interested in living overseas. And I was wondering, is that maybe they weren't interested in living overseas because they were band leaders and had to make decisions for other people other than themselves?
So that is definitely a piece of it. And yet all three of them had bandmates who would have relished, I think, at least for a few years living in Paris or in Africa or wherever, as much as these band leaders did themselves. And I think that they could have filled up their band with extraordinary European talent in about 15 seconds. One of the things that they did, they had an interesting relationship as band leaders. And this is more about Ellington and Basie, because Armstrong was never really a band leader in the same way. With him, it was more about him, and he had small groups and they didn't last over time. But with Ellington and Basie, it was a trade-off for the sidemen. If you were with the Basie band or the Ellington band, it was the kind of experience that could make your career. You would be known forever in a way that if you were out there on your own would have been tougher to be known because you were part of the great Duke Ellington or Count Basie. On the other hand, you would watch Ellington especially and Basie a little bit steal things from you and not always credit you. Maybe the most famous song that if you were to go into any normal audience of jazz fans or of people who only knew Ellington vaguely and you ask them, what's the signature song of Duke Ellington? They would probably say, Take the A Train. And probably most people don't know the backstory behind that song.
It's a Billy Strayhorn connection.
It was Billy Strayhorn. Billy Strayhorn, who was a young guy in Pittsburgh who wanted a job with the Ellington band. And he called up Duke Ellington. Ellington said, come to Harlem and interview with me. He sent him directions, and the directions included taking a train called the A Train. Mm-hmm. And Strayhorn figured, geez, if I could turn those directions into a song, won't I look brilliant? He did it. It was a terrific song. Ellington hired him. He adopted the song. And about one of every three times that he played Take the A Train, he bothered to credit Billy Strayhorn. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the time, people just assumed it was one of Duke Ellington's 6,000 compositions.
We're talking about, I don't want to focus, you know, you got three people, and it's Basie, it's Armstrong, and Ellington. But I was looking at Ellington as a composer, you know, Ellington giving us his sacred music, Ellington as an experimenter, or Ellington just in turn, not as a band leader, but as a great piano player. And talk about how sometimes maybe we overlook the composer of Duke Ellington.
So we overlook everything but his band leading at times. People know about the Duke Ellington band, and all they care about is listening to that music. But they have to know that he generally arranged the music. He composed most of the music. I said 6,000 songs. Some people say more. And he was a piano player that if that's all he did, he could still have been known as a great piano player. It was the idea that he did four things at once made any one of them at times get lost in the shadow of the other three. So he deserves his spot on the Mount Rushmore of jazz for four different reasons.
Let's talk about something which, before we get to the end of our show, I think is important. We're talking about these images. Talk about all three of these individuals and film. You know, I went back and I looked at the scene of Count Basie in Blazing Saddles, which I think is just a really fascinating scene. But talk about film. You know, I mean, some of these individuals, you know, they were composing music to like the Walt Disney cartoons. But talk about their presence. Louis Armstrong, some people just remember him from the images that they see.
Yes. So all three of them played roles in film that went beyond their just being band leaders. I think one of the funniest scenes in Blazing Saddles was the Count Basie band showing up, you know, in the middle of the desert. In movies that Louis Armstrong appeared in with people like Fred Astaire and Frank Sinatra, Armstrong stole the camera. He was such a presence that it wasn't just his being a band leader. The same way that Louis Armstrong also stole scenes by his singing. He had a voice that was the unlikeliest voice on the planet to be a famous voice. And yet his raspy voice was so popular that when he was starting out in Chicago, young kids would stick their head out of a car window in the middle of winter to catch cold so they could sound like the great Louis Armstrong. And Duke Ellington did the same thing in all the media that he was in. He was a star of radio. He became a star of TV. He was in the movies and he was in the concert hall. He could write symphonies. He wrote a symphony that told the story of Blacks in America called Black, Brown, and Beige that took the story of Blacks from the time of slavery through Reconstruction into the civil rights era. And actually, Ellington said that jazz itself was the story of Black America. He wanted to rename the music form from jazz to call it Negro music.
Let me ask you something, gets into you, Larry Tye, as a writer, okay? You talked about all the interviews that you did, okay? I'm assuming you also looked at some of these films with, like, say, Louis Armstrong. Is there anything that when you looked at, say, this film closely, and you can, you know, stop it, put it on pause, and you say, you know, I see something here in Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington's face, that really seems to give me, like, there's something else happening in this scene, and maybe it's given me a deeper understanding of who this person is that I didn't get from the writing?
Yes. So, very good question. And the answer is somebody, a journalist from New Orleans, sent me a small movie picture clip that somebody had taken on the streets of New Orleans when Louis Armstrong was a teenager hawking newspapers in New Orleans. And nobody had ever seen this. It was an amazing little homemade film that showed that I talked about capturing the camera, that at age 13, hawking newspapers, Louis Armstrong had about him the sense of charisma that with no sound and just watching him light up himself in terms of the way he was smiling and light up this screen, you had a sense that this was something that he didn't develop in his career as a jazzman, that he was almost born with this sense of magical capturing of the camera and of people's imagination.
Talking about imagination, when we see some of these individuals, there's always these women. And I'm looking at how when we look at someone like Jackie Robinson, you know, we have Rachel Robinson, and it probably, I remember Buzzy Bivese said, look, I went up to Canada. I was going to talk to Jackie Robinson, but I sat next to Rachel Robinson and I didn't have to talk to Jackie. So that's stability there. Now, I know that these jazz musicians are on the road and things of that sort, but so were some of the Negro baseball players. When you look at the stability in terms of the role women play, okay, what women are very important for Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Count Basie?
Sure. So I want to talk about women in each of their lives. Mm-hmm. And these were three men of deep faith. They believed in God. They prayed before every meal. They all read the Bible, and Duke Ellington claimed to have read it cover to cover three times. But when it came to the Ten Commandments, we could also go through long lists of where they broke them. And I'd like to use that as the segue to the question about
women.
You're
saying they also were worshiping the calf, is what you're saying.
They were absolutely doing that. And I'm saying that. So let's start with Count Basie. Count Basie had a wife and a marriage in Kansas City. Kansas City's where he started with his great swing music. And in Kansas City, his marriage lasted for about 13 seconds. And it lasted for that short a time because he was a bit of a derelict in those days. His wife, when she divorced him, had a long list of complaints, none of which he ever contested. But he learned. When he left Kansas City, he got his act together in major ways. He was making more money. He stopped the heavy drinking that he was doing. And he married one woman after that who lasted most of his life. Catherine Bassey was an amazing woman. She put up with the fact that at times the Count was unfaithful. She actually left him twice, but she was a driving force behind him. She was the presence that was pulling him to activism, whether it was with Jackie Robinson or Martin Luther King, on fundraising, on being actively involved in civil rights groups. She was an amazing force in Count Basie's life, and he was the first to acknowledge that. Louis Armstrong had four wives. The first three were relatively short-term marriages. The last one was with Lucille Armstrong, who again lasted most of his adult life, and she again tolerated his unfaithfulness, but she was the stability, she was the home life, she was so much of what was good about Louis Armstrong in all those years, I attribute to the wonderful Lucille Armstrong. Duke Ellington was a little bit different. He stayed married to the same woman his entire life, even though he only lived with her as her real husband for a few years after they had a son. But he had perpetual mistresses, and he stayed married to that same woman because she gave him the perfect excuse not to have to marry any of his mistresses. And Duke's granddaughter, Mercedes, took me on a long tour of Duke Ellington's life in Harlem. The tour took a while when we looked at all the places that he had lived. It took a while when we looked at all the places where he had played. But it took a long while when we looked at all the places that he stashed his mistresses across the city. And that was how he liked to live. And he was charming to women. They found him appealing enough that they all knew he had other women in his life. And he told us the mistress and the woman who married the most by looking at his grave site in the Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx, where he is married with his mother, who he loved, on one side, and his favorite mistress on the other side.
Talk about these men as fathers.
So Louis Armstrong had no children,
right,
in spite of the fact that there is a book out there now by a woman who says that she is Louis Armstrong's daughter. I believe what Louis Armstrong's wife Lucille said, which is after trying so hard with four marriages that he couldn't have children. But he raised a nephew named Clarence, who was somebody who had had an accident at home and fell on his head when he was a child and had a disability for the rest of his life, a mental disability. But Louis Armstrong raised him as his son, and Clarence Armstrong took Louis's name and loved Louis Armstrong. The Duke Ellington had one child, a son named Mercer, who he encouraged and almost compelled to join his band. He became his band manager. He played an instrument in the band, and he felt like it was impossible to ever live up to his father's standards, and his father helped make him feel that way. Count Basie had one child, a daughter named Diane, who had a score of mental and physical disabilities. The Count and his wife gave her everything. They wouldn't listen to people who said she should be institutionalized. And this child was predicted to live into her 20s if she was lucky. She died last year at age 70-something. And all three, in their own ways, tried their best to be good parents, and they did it the way they knew best.
You know, when we look at the jazz men, you know, a lot of the material that you acquire was before we had social media. I was wondering, in terms of how social media operates today, would we see these individuals differently?
We would know infinitely more about them. They would share stories. People would share stories about them. The kinds of stories that I get from people who come up to me at every book talk that I do and say, geez, I heard the Count Basie band playing here, and this is what it was like to see them. Those stories wouldn't mean as much if people instantaneously had said to everybody they know in the world, here's my selfie shot, you know, with Count Basie. I love the idea that they weren't around in that era, and that it is tougher to find the stories. And so every one of them, to me, is a little more precious than today, where sharing is so easy.
Yeah, I want to go back to something you were mentioning with Louis Armstrong, and that was his singing. And it seems as if he must have gave rise to every trumpet player wants to sing. You know, I'm thinking of Wynton Marsalis and Chet Baker. Is that a thing where, in terms of the difficulty of playing a horn and singing, how difficult is that in terms of breath?
So I think it's incredibly difficult. It's in terms of breath, but it's also in terms of lips. Playing a trumpet like Louis Armstrong did, as hard, as intensely, and as often as he did, made his lips at times feel truly parched and actually bleed. And the idea of doing that, singing with a sore mouth and bleeding lips, must have been incredibly difficult. On the other hand, I think it sometimes, for Armstrong and for others who have followed, it sometimes gives their lips a break. As tough as singing is, it's a whole lot easier on the lips than blowing into a wind instrument perpetually.
I remember people talking about, you know, the problem that John Coltrane had with his teeth and his mouth, that sometimes, you know, the horn would be filled with blood when he, you know, when he took it out of his mouth. And we think about, you know, just the physical aspect of playing these instruments. How did these individuals deal with the traveling? Did it ever take its toll in terms of?
It took an enormous toll. Traveling those 300 days a year that we were talking about, and in good days, it was traveling by Pullman sleeping car. In bad days, it was a beat up old bus or a jalopy that was falling apart. It was getting to a hotel and realizing that you either had to keep the lights on all night to keep the bugs in their crevices, or you had to actually put newspapers under your mattress so the crinkling sound would make the cockroaches scared and go away. It was enormously stressful for them. But I want to tell you the kind of traveling that I think they did that made a difference in terms of households across America and in terms of their racial impact. I think what happened, and I wasn't there, so I can't prove it in every house, but I think that a lot of white men in those years, the 30s, 40s, 50s, into the 60s, a lot of white men who would never have let a black man cross their threshold wooed their sweethearts with the music of the gravel-throated Louis Armstrong or the Ellington Band. I think a lot of white women who, if a white man had come towards them on the sidewalk, would have walked to the other side of the street. When they were in their old own living room, they kicked off their high heels and they tapped their toes to the music of Count Basie's swinging orchestra. I think that these men, in a way that was subtle, but was incredibly effective, wooed America with the magnificence of their melodies and opened our ears to their humanity. And I think that's what Martin Luther King was talking about when he called them essentially revolutionaries, but quiet and subversive revolutionaries.
My last question to you, Larry Ty. If I was a jazz musician, young jazz musician, what would you like your book to tell me? I mean, in terms of what should I learn from these three men's life that perhaps would strengthen me as a jazz musician in terms of how I see my country, how I deal with racial injustice? What type of thing, if I pick up this book and I look at these three people that you've profiled?
So the lesson that I would like to leave you with is the lesson that the wonderful Sonny Rollins left me with in the two interviews I did with him, which is recognize as an entertainer, be it a musician or any kind of entertainer, that you have a mouthpiece and a megaphone to speak to the world about things matter, and recognize that your legacy shouldn't end up being only about your music. It ought to be about your humanity.
Well, very nicely said, Larry Ty. And I also want to commend you in terms of, if we're doing a fundraiser, we're going to bring you back because you see you have perfected this. And I guess the best way to end our conversation is the way Duke Ellington would just say, we love you madly, Larry. We love you madly.
So okay? I love you too. And thank you for having me on.
Okay. My guest today has been Larry Ty. He's the author of The Jazz Man, How Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Sunday, July 7th, 4 to 8 p.m., WPFW is presenting a fundraising evening of roots, rock, reggae at Mango Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road, Bladensburg, Maryland, featuring Proverbs reggae band with Z-Lion and special guest Freedom and Soroma V.L. Proceeds to benefit WPFW. Details at WPFWFM.org.
PACA, Pan-African Community Action, will be holding the Community Town Hall, The Harm of Crime Bills, and the Future of Community Power in Chaka City. On Saturday, July 13th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., D.C. residents are invited to discuss how the Secure D.C. Crime Bill targets the black working class and criminalizes our youth, and how to develop real people-centered solutions to community safety. There will be speakers, group exercises, lunch, and a performance by the Afro-Go-Go Roots Collective, Crank Lukongo Unplugged. The Harm of Crime Bills and the Future of Community Power in Chocolate City, Saturday, July 13th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the RISE Demonstration Center, 2730 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More information and registration can be found online, PACA, that's P-A-C-A, crimebilltownhall.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Pacifica National Board and the WPFW Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica Bylaws Amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the pacifica.org website.
Sunday's a special on 89.3 FM. Join host Miyuki Williams on WPFW and treat yourself to a Sunday kind of love. From noon until 2 p.m. each and every week on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings, here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
WPFW's 2024 election to seat members to represent you on the local station board has started. Renew your membership by making a minimum donation of $25 or completing 3 hours of eligible volunteer work by June 30th in order to be a candidate, nominate candidates, or vote. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information or call 707-500-1910 to leave a voicemail for the election supervisor.
This is movement time, and when it's movement time, we can all be together.
Reverend Dr. William Barber.
We are here to announce on June the 29th at 10 o'clock on Pennsylvania and 3rd, we are calling for the Mass Poor People's Low Wage Workers Assembly and Moral March on Washington and to the polls, June 29th, 2024. We're saying the last picture of D.C. ought not be people tearing the Capitol up and trying to tear democracy down. We need a picture of folk trying to build a democracy up and lift up all people, regardless of who they are. June the 29th on Pennsylvania and 3rd.